Thank you very much indeed, Professor Marley, for joining us this evening. Tell us about the background to the G7 Science Academy's statement on biodiversity. Why did you produce it, and what are the key points?
Well, there was a feeling that the G7 have a major role to play in addressing the biodiversity crisis. The G7 accounts for 10% of the world's population, but about 40% of the world's consumption of biological resources, the consumption of nature. So there's an important moral role for the G7 to play in this, and also a potential of leadership there. And if this group of nations that is so influential and also has a large fraction of the global wealth can take major actions, both within the G7 countries, but also support actions across the world as a whole, they can play a defining role in moving things forward in this arena. And so, together with the science academies of the other G7 nations, the Royal Society pulled together a set of recommendations after several meetings and discussions. But briefly, there are three recommendations in total. The first one was very much aligned to what we just heard Arthur talk about, which is about working to embed multiple values of biodiversity into economic planning and thinking. And multiple values of human well-being as well, to go beyond narrow economic definitions to a much more integrated approach. And the second recommendation was about what we termed integrating Earth systems thinking into planning for the future, and linking up economic planning, human development planning, with understanding of climate and biodiversity and joined up decisions, pathways forward. And the final recommendation was around monitoring biodiversity. How will we know when things are going wrong, but also when things are going right? What are the gaps in our ability to understand the world's immense biological diversity? And how can we improve that, both in terms of technological capacity, but also in strengthening capacity in the global south, where most of the world's biodiversity is found?
Thank you very much for identifying those three key themes. One of them is this kind of integrated Earth system thinking, which you say you believe should, the academies do, generate cross-sectoral solutions. Now, a lot of the people who will be participating in this event will have a background in science and technology, will be involved in shaping these through work they do either in the commercial sector or in the research and government sector. So could you tell us a little bit more about what these integrated Earth system thinking solutions look like? What kind of things people who are sitting there listening to this managing budget should be doing?
Yes, I can run through a few examples. So the underlying principle is thinking about the biophysical limits of the Earth, the capacity of biodiversity when thinking about economic plans or trade plans or others, and so bringing that in there. But just to run through a few examples, establishing pathways that combine sustainable agricultural yields, so improving nutrition for humanity while protecting biodiversity and staying within a safe climate space. Another one is very timely now, is managing biodiversity and trade to minimize the risk of emergence and spread of infectious diseases, both the emergence originally, but also the international connectivity around them and having protocols around that. One that's also rising in prominence is the idea of nature-based solutions, having ways that can contribute towards mitigating or adapting to climate change, but also help us address the biodiversity crisis and can also help in terms of human development. Understanding our supply chains better. So when we're consuming things in local shops, can we have transparency in where they're coming from, what the biodiversity and environmental impacts are there? And on the and also not just recognizing things in terms of impacts where biodiversity exists, but also recognizing the fundamental importance of demand in the G7 nations in shaping those patterns overall. So for example, one thing is encouraging a shift towards more plant-based diets. And not necessarily everybody becoming vegetarian or vegan, but decreasing the footprint of meat in our diets, because that is a major cause of much of the world's land use, which is a major cause of biodiversity loss and degradation.
Thanks very much. And then We've obviously, you mentioned as your third strand, sort of monitoring. Just tell us, especially with the COP meeting coming up in October, just tell us what kind of monitoring you would hope to see as a result of that. How can we know how we're doing?
Well, I think there are two aspects to it. One is that, say, in countries like the UK, we have a relatively decent understanding and monitoring of our biodiversity, or many aspects of our biodiversity. But in many countries in the tropics, where I've worked a lot of my career, it's really hard to support that detailed long-term biological tracking, partially because the biology is so much more overwhelming, there's so much more of it, and partially simply because the resources and the capacity aren't there. And I think there's huge potential to really strengthen those monitoring networks, particularly in these biodiversity-rich countries. And also perhaps extending it beyond the obvious charismatic aspects of monitoring. We all love birds and mammals, and they're quite well studied and monitored overall. But it's the insects, for example, that are crucial to many of the essential life support functions of biodiversity, or the soil creatures. There is a vast biological understanding there, but there's much more that we need to understand before we understand when things are beginning to fall apart, or when we're beginning to rebuild natural ecosystems sufficiently to keep them healthy and resilient.
Great, thanks very much. Those are also issues I'm sure we'll come back to in the Q&A. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Marley. Thank you.